Today is Monday, November 15th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Jess Landing, and this is News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It's 5:07 and time for a full hour of independent news. In campus news, we'll be bringing you a story on the second international conference on gateways and corridors, hosted by our own Sauder School of Business. We'll also be bringing you a discussion of the third annual World Peace Forum teach-in, which took place this weekend. And in local news, we will have an interview with NDP MP Nikki Ashton from Manitoba, who was on campus earlier today discussing her bill to improve Canadian higher education.
And today we will bring you Megan Turcotto's weekly City Hall update, which you can hear every Monday on News 101. And we will hear from Adam Yanush in our weekly arts feature.
All this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Radio News. Locals in a small southeastern California town are battling an energy giant again. Residents of Hinckley, California, say their well water is tainted by a nearby Pacific Gas and Electric Company plant. State water officials say a plume of groundwater with elevated levels of a heavy metal isotope, chromium-6, is migrating. PG&E officials say they are mitigating the spread and that levels of the cancer-causing isotope do not exceed those that occur in nature. But locals say levels are rising quickly, as much as 700% over the past 3 years. More than 20 years ago, residents in Hinckley accepted a $300 million settlement from PG&E for cancers caused by chromium seepage into local water supplies. Relatives of a 20-year-old Egyptian man found dead in an Alexandria canal last week say he was tortured and killed by local police. Ahmed Shaban's family says he was detained by police earlier this month and refused to be searched. They were contacted days later and asked to identify his body. A family member describes his injuries.
His nails, oh dear God, are removed. The areas around his eyes are dark blue and swollen. His arm is ripped from here to here. His stomach is ripped open. He's injured in his head. He's injured in his neck. Marks of beating everywhere.
Shaban's death was reported by a local blogger. Authorities say he killed himself. Two officers from the same police precinct were charged in the June beating death of Khalid Saeed. Supporters of imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier say prison authorities are denying him access to proper medical care. Jaisal Noor has more.
Family members of Peltier say his medical condition is worsening. Concerns about the possibility of cancer or other serious kidney problems spurred officials in the U.S. penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, to give the 66-year-old a blood test in June. Peltier was only given the results last week, and the tests came back negative. Peltier's prison doctor has ordered a biopsy, but there has been no indication that it has been scheduled. Delaney Bruce is the director of the Leonard Peltier Defense Offense Committee.
At minimum, we would want the government to have this biopsy done immediately so that we do know exactly what we're dealing with.
Bruce says she does not believe Peltier, who has maintained his innocence during the 34 years he has spent behind bars, will be granted proper medical care as long as he remains imprisoned. She is calling for his immediate release. Peltier was denied parole last year and is not eligible again for parole until 2024, when he is 79 years old. Jessel Noor, FSRN.
Tension in Haiti's Cap-Haïtien is growing, along with the number of people who are dying from cholera. Protesters clashed with riot police in the northern coastal city today, and schools were shut down. As of Sunday, the death toll topped 900. More than 14,000 people have been hospitalized. A UN spokesperson said today that the disease is now prevalent across the earthquake and hurricane-ravaged island nation, where citizens will elect a new president later this month. A forum of candidates was held in Miami yesterday. Just three of the 19 vying for the post attended. According to the Inter-American Development Bank, Haitian Americans send more than $1.6 billion back to Haiti each year. Over the weekend, Mexican authorities broke up a modern-day slaving operation in the southern state of Chiapas. Shannon Young has more.
A tip from an escaped slave reportedly led to the rescue of more than 100 people from a banana plantation in Tapachula, Chiapas this weekend. Most of the former captives are Central American nationals. At least five are Mexican citizens. Dozens, including the informant, are under the age of 18. Federal agents arrested eight people in the operation, including plantation overseers and administrative staff. The plantation is located in a region near the border with Guatemala, along a route often used by migrants headed towards the United States. Undocumented transmigration through Mexico has grown increasingly dangerous in the past few years, as organized crime has consolidated control over the most heavily trafficked routes. This has led to an explosion in migrant kidnappings for ransom or forced labor. One of this year's most extreme examples of the dangers the undocumented face in Mexican territory is the massacre of 72 migrants in the northern state of Tamaulipas, a crime attributed to the Zetas drug cartel. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
After walking out of the Iraqi parliament late last week, Sunni lawmakers returned over the weekend, saying they would participate in a power-sharing agreement after all. The deal calls for Prime Minister al-Maliki to appoint a cabinet before the end of the year and for the creation of a National Security Council headed up by Iraqiya leader Ayad Alawi. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Now it's time for our own News 101 headlines. In campus news, this week's UBC's Sauder School of Business will be hosting various dignitaries at the second International Conference on Gateways and Corridors. Speakers include Alberta's Minister of International and Intergovernmental Relations, Iris Wong, and China's Minister of Transport, Shengling Li, among others. The conference covers a variety of topics relating to strategic transportation, logistics, and collaboration, such as the increasingly important role of Canada's Pacific Gateway in reshaping relations with China, the role of strategic collaboration between Canada's western provinces, the impact of opening Arctic waters on international shipping, and the emerging trend of making firm supply chains more environmentally conscious. Sauder School of Business professor David Gillen, director of the Center for Transportation Studies, says, quote, "This international forum will allow us to understand the vital forces at work in global trade and transport, so we can coordinate our efforts and restructure how we add value in Canada's Pacific Gateway and other corridors," end quote. The conference will run from Wednesday, November 17th through till Friday, November 19th, downtown at the Sutton Place Hotel.
In international news, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development just released its annual report measuring how well university graduates from 11 industrialized countries utilized their education. Canada came in second to last place, coming in ahead only of Spain. The report found that about 38% of Canadian university graduates between the ages of 25 and 29 were, quote, "working at a low skill level," end quote. This shows a disparity between what is being learned in Canadian universities and what is required in today's workplace. Some analysts believe this trend is the result of fewer students attaining degrees in math and science. In the academic year of 2008 to 2009, Statistics Canada reported that only 1 in 5 undergraduates were pursuing degrees in engineering, mathematics, information technology, and other sciences.
The animal advocacy group, Stop UBC Animal Research, has filed a formal complaint with the British Columbia government against the University of British Columbia. The group, which has requested that the university release records regarding its animal research, claims that UBC has failed to meet deadlines set out under BC's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. The Act requires UBC to respond within 20 days of a request to waive fees for producing the documents. Stop UBC Animal Research made such a request on September 10th, stating that the fees must be waived because the organization is an all-volunteer group, and the release of records is in the public interest, and also that the information requested cannot be obtained through publicly accessible sources. The advocacy group gained national notoriety earlier this year when it began an aggressive campaign for greater transparency in UBC's animal research practices. In a press release, the group's spokesperson stated that, quote, "The public has a right to know what UBC is doing to animals with taxpayer dollars. If UBC is so proud of its animal research, why is it the university is refusing to hand over information about its experiments? What does UBC have to hide?" End quote.
In more campus news, on Thursday, hundreds flocked to the UBC War Memorial Gym to see something quite different from the gymnasium's usual offering of sports games. The annual UBC Remembrance Day ceremony was well attended, and many students, as well as staff and other community members, were present to hear performances from the UBC School of Music, along with a variety of readings and discourses. Speakers included AMS President Bijan Amajian and Vancouver Liberal MP Joyce Murray.
In more campus news, a recent study conducted at UBC's School of Medicine found that Kenyans who received a weekly text message check-in were 12% more likely to have an undetectable level of the HIV virus a year after starting antiretroviral treatment, also known as ART, than a control group who did not receive the message. Conducted by clinical assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Diseases in the Faculty of Medicine, Dr. Richard Lester, the study began in May of 2007 when 538 enrolled in the WellTel Kenya 1 and continued until October 2009. Half of the patients were randomly selected to receive a weekly text message asking how they were and were asked to respond within 48 hours. While the text messages were not intended as medication reminders, patients reported that they felt like someone cared and were able to address problems if they arose, ultimately preventing health crises. With such success in his first study, Lester will soon lead 2 additional pilot studies within British Columbia using the same method.
And in local news, BC's first multimedia child rights public awareness campaign is being launched this week in the hopes of challenging attitudes and assumptions about children and the role they play in today's society. Initiated by the Society for Children and of Youth BC, along with their partners, the campaign has the potential to reach 5.5 million views each year with public transit ads, social media, newsletters, a campaign website, child rights posters, and public service announcements running province-wide. Tina Tam, the executive director of the Society for Children and Youth of BC, believes that, quote, "There has never been a greater need in BC for child rights education and advocacy. The first step is awareness," end quote.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
1-866-662-8300.
Industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here on 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
I can listen to them and go, this is ridiculous, and people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Claire Eagle. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. It's 5:24 and time for your weekly weather forecast. For that, we go to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Claire. There's a wind warning in effect for our Metro Vancouver tonight, as a low-pressure system will be hitting the southwest coast tonight. Expect temperatures to drop this week and the weather to become nicer by the end of the week. Here's your UBC forecast. For tonight, cloudy with 60% chance of showers. Overnight, wind speeds increasing to 60 kilometers per hour near the ocean. Low of 8 degrees. For tomorrow, cloudy with sunny periods. Windy in the morning and easing up in the afternoon. 60% chance of showers in the evening. High of 10 degrees, low of 6. On Wednesday, rain and wind throughout the day. High of 8, low of 4 degrees. For Thursday, showers, low of 7 degrees again, high of 9. For Friday, 60% chance of showers, high of 6 degrees, low of 1. On Saturday, small chance of showers with a high of 4 degrees and a low of 0. And for Sunday, mix of sun and cloud with a high of 3 and a low of negative 2 degrees. Currently, it is 11 degrees and cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 9 degrees and a low of 3. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, as always, to Daniel Casanova and the Storm Club of UBC for bringing us that forecast. We now go to Adam Janusz for our weekly arts report. Adam went to Headline Theatre to talk to co-founder and artistic director David Diamond about the theatre's latest production, titled Us and Them.
Us and Them, The Inquiry. It's an intimate evening of interactive slash participatory theater where audiences get to become part of the performance and explore the question, why do we create divisions between us and other people? There are no actors and there's no script. Instead, theatrical techniques are used to explore stories brought to the fore by members of the audience themselves. Us and Them has been running in several different venues around town since October the 22nd and will continue tonight and throughout November. I spoke to artistic director and co-founder of Headlines Theater, David Diamond, about this unique application of theater and what results he's seeing so far. And my first question to David was, how is Us and Them different from a typical play?
Well,
This particular project, Us and Them, is even more not typical than Headline's normal work. In Us and Them, there really is no play, there's no actors, there's no script. There's just me and a group of people each night in very different venues using the language of the theater to explore our desires and our fears around the creation of the other. Why is it that humanity needs to create the other? Mm-hmm. And when do we figure out that there's really only us here?
So if there's no actors, how does that play out? How does that work? Do the people in the audience, is it more like a panel discussion?
No. We're using the language of the theater, and everything comes out of the audience each night. And so each night I'll ask for people to offer stories out of their own lives, their own real lives. The room will choose one story. Mm. It's a story of either when a person was turned into the other or that person turned somebody else into the other. The stories have been sometimes very simple, and it's the simplest stories, you know, that are the most profound sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somebody else from the audience comes to play that other the other person. We're not there to do a psychoanalysis of the storyteller. We're there to make theater.
Mm-hmm.
Once we put the moment on the stage, we can then delve into the two characters and turn the internal fears and desires of the characters into characters on the stage that yet other people from the audience end up playing.
Mm-hmm.
So we people the stage with the fears and desires of both characters, and through improvisational work, we can peel the layers of complexity away from what starts off as a real moment, but has become a symbol that the whole room owns.
Can you give us an example from a recent show? Because you've been sort of touring around Vancouver with this project. So
yeah.
I wonder if you could give us a sort of an example.
A few nights ago, we did one at the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House that I think was very radical. And the reason it was radical was the story came from a young woman who had been demonstrating against the Olympics. And the moment was between her and a police officer. The plan has been that the whole thing will be nonviolent, and then it starts to get kind of out of other people start to, you know, destroy property and stuff, and she gets all heated up, and she gets confronted by a police officer, and she starts to really push back, and he pushes her to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this moment when he pushes her to the ground that we end up exploring. The police officer ends up being played by a man who was a police officer in South Africa during apartheid.
Wow.
And so because, you know, whatever the story is, we're there to honor both sides of the story. We're not there to demonize any one side of the story.
Right. And so from that, what are you seeing that comes out of that? Or what do you hope at the end of Us and Them that people walk away from it with?
Well, in this evening, there were a number of people who do, you know, I've been to my fair share of demonstrations in my day, you know, and so there are a number of younger generation people now who are really spearheading those battles, and they loved this, and what they loved about it is they themselves said, you know, in these moments, we don't ever try to think about the human being in the uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And what that person is actually thinking and feeling in these moments. And if we did that, our tactics might change.
Right, so there's a dehumanization that happens in the moment, and what you're hoping is to kind of put the humanity back into these people in these situations?
Because if we could actually really figure out that there is only ever us here, what kind of systems and structures would grow out of us that would truly transform the world?
What do you see this being more effective than, say, being in a protest or another form of action? Where do you see this kind of theatrical-based work being perhaps more successful or...
Well, you know, humans think in metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think in words. We think in pictures. And the theater is a metaphoric language. I actually don't think the transformation happens from our intellect. It happens from our hearts.
Mm. So Us and Them is actually playing on Thursday the 18th, the Vancouver Aboriginal Friendship Center, and at PL 1222. There's two shows on Friday and Saturday on the 19th and the 20th. That's at William Street, 1422 William Street in Vancouver. That's being put on by New World Theatre. That's their sort of home base, PL 1222. And there's one more show on Sunday the 21st at Café du Soleil on Commercial Drive. So, yeah, tons of opportunities to get involved in Us and Them. And thanks to David Diamond for that interview.
As always, thanks to Adam for that. That was our weekly arts report brought to you by Adam Yanoush. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Claire Eagle. This past weekend, the World Peace Forum Society hosted their 2010 teach-in at Langara College titled The 50s. The World Peace Forum works to create spaces and events where activists, academics, and artists committed to promoting peace, social justice, and sustainability can come together to discuss and plan. We have committee member Rachel Toot on the line now. Rachel, can you tell us a bit about the teach-in that took place this weekend?
Sure, yeah. We had our third annual teach-in, actually. We've been doing this for a few years now. And as you said, the title was The 50s, Reconstruction versus Revolution and the First War on Terror. So we were looking at the period after World War II, so this is the time of the Cold War through the end of the 40s and all through the 50s. And we had an amazing number of wonderful speakers and cultural events. Listening to your last speaker was great because we do try and incorporate the arts and artists into what we're doing as well, because we believe that that also gets at the heart. And we had a really great event. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds great. Can you tell me a bit about maybe some of the specific talks that went on? I was looking at the schedule, and there seemed to be a great variety out there.
Yeah, there really was. I'll tell you about the plenaries first, and then I can tell you about the workshops afterwards. So the main plenaries on the weekend part of the teach-in, our first was the Cold War and the New Imperialism. That was by Henry Heller. He's a history professor based out of Winnipeg, and he was talking about how the Cold War changed the world and what was going on in terms of the Cold War with the different parts of the world in that time period. Then we had the Cold War in Asia and Africa and the Colonial Revolution, and that was presented by Gary Crystal. And after that, the breakthrough, the Cuban Revolution, and we actually had a veteran of the Cuban Revolution come from Cuba. His name is Manuel Yepe, and he presented what went on, how the revolution in Cuba took place and what their goals were and sort of what they achieved at the time.
Wow, that sounds really interesting.
It was great, yeah. And then the next one was the Cold War, the home front. So this was what was going on here in North America. And we had Amir Kadir from Quebec. He's actually from Quebec Solidaire, which is a new political party in Quebec. And we had Arthur Manuel, who is a First Nations activist, and a fellow by the name of Roger Kieran from the United States. And so they were talking about different aspects of the Cold War, McCarthyism, and what was happening to our First Nations people, what was happening in Quebec during that time. So those were the plenaries from Saturday. Then on Sunday, we had a fellow by the name of Paul Buell, he's a historian, but he's a graphic novelist. So he was talking about the cultures of discontent, so the cultural struggles and the things that were going on in terms of people's struggles and the desires of the world waking up to what was happening in the Cold War world that were expressed through art. And our last plenary was The Way Forward to Peace, Sustainability, and Social Justice. And again, that was Amir Kadir and Paul Buell. And they presented some ideas as to how we learn from the period that we were talking about and apply it to today and look forward to what can we do today to build a peaceful, just, and sustainable world.
So I guess then going off of what you said the last talk was about, Were you hoping to, I guess, inform listeners or inspire them to action?
Really, I guess we think that it's all part of the same thing. There's all our teach-ins have been based on looking at history and specific periods in time, seeing how the things that were going on there could apply to today, and then taking from those experiences what worked, what didn't work, learning from them in order to inspire us to act now. We know that there's lots going on now that has its roots in the 30s, in the period just before World War II, in the period after World War II, that are affecting the world today. And there was all kinds of upheavals and resistance at the time, people hoping for a better world. And, it's great for us to be able to look back, learn from it, so that we can act today.
It's definitely a very interesting time period with a lot to learn, for
there,
sure.
Yeah, there was.
I guess, how has the teach-in changed in the last 3 years? As you said, this is the third annual one. And how have you seen it grow? Has it become bigger, or
well, the very first thing that happened was in June 2006, and that was a peace forum that was huge. So that was took many staff and a couple of years in the making, and 5,000 people or more from all over the world came to that. And then in 2007, we organized a small Peace Without Borders at the Peace Arch to bring together Canadian and U.S. Peace and social justice activists. So then the first teach-in happened to be 9 years after the war, the end of World War One. So we decided to take that as our starting point. And then 2009... the economic collapse had just happened, and so we thought, okay, the period from 1929, the economic collapse, to 1939, which ended in, of course, World War II, would be a great period to investigate, because we didn't want that our current economic collapse to be ending up in another world war. So we thought it'd be good to learn. And this year's teach-in followed from that. And we're finding that what we're really trying to do is reach out to young activists. And so that's kind of where we're focusing on spreading the word and building people to come from all aspects of all age groups and artists, activists, and academics.
That's definitely really interesting. I guess one more question, just regarding what you said about involving artists as well. Mm-hmm. What sort of ideas does the World Peace Forum have to, I guess, incorporate the work of artists as activists? And, I mean, do you do it through exhibitions or through talks? Or, like, how do you work the artistic aspect into the more social and historical aspects?
Yeah, on part of our teach-in involved an afternoon event, cultural event, on Remembrance Day, the afternoon of Remembrance Day. And so we had our Cuban guest, Manuel Yepi, speaking about his activism as a youth, because he was young. He was a young man. So he spoke a little bit about activism as youth. And then we had a musician play quite a lot of music, an activist musician, Jeff Berner. And so he sang and played his activist inspiring music for us. And then we showed the movie. It was a 1951 movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still. So it was a very a movie with a great peace message that was specifically aimed at that Cold War period. So that was part of our artist involvement. And then because Paul Buell is an artist, he's a graphic novelist, he was talking about culture and how culture can be expressed express resistance. And he talked a lot about the movies and the television shows and the children's books of the time that were expressing the culture of resistance. And we also showed a movie during our teach-in. It was called Betrayed, the story of the Canadian Seamen's Union and what happened to that union during the time of the Cold War. And so those were some of the ways that we incorporate artists into our goals.
Definitely sounds like there's something for everyone there, Rachel. We're really looking forward to seeing what the World Peace Forum has in store for the future.
Well, and what you can do once once we get it up on our website, we film just about all of it, and we did film just about all of it. And so if you go to our Facebook site or to our website, you'll be able to watch all of the, just about all of the presentations that happen, as you can for the 2009 and the 2008 teach-in. So they're all available to watch anytime.
Perfect. We'll definitely check that out. Thanks Great. So much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
All right. Have a good day.
Bye.
And that was Claire Eagle interviewing Rachel Toot about this past weekend's third annual World Peace Forum teach-in held at Langara College. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us.
A video of the incident was posted on YouTube.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Claire Eagle. We now go to Megan Turcato's weekly City Hall update, which you'll hear every Monday here on News 101.
All you people up there in City Hall, this is a song for the people in the streets and the people, City Hall.
City Hall makes a lot of little decisions that affect us all in big ways. This segment asks, what happened at City Hall this week?
And here's your bevy of...
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Nikki Ashton, who is the youngest woman MP in Parliament today. First off, hello, welcome to the sub at UBC.
City Hall makes a lot of little decisions that affect us all in big ways. This segment asks, what happened at City Hall this week? City staffers are predicting a shortfall of over $20 million for next year's budget. The city was originally predicting a deficit of over $60 million, but was able to cut this down by two-thirds through a variety of small measures, such as sending city employees their pay stubs via the web rather than by mail. The shortfall is being blamed on several factors. The lack of new construction starts this year meant a drop in tax revenue for the city, while an increase in inflation, salary increases for staff under new collective agreements, and an increase in the operating cost of new facilities have put pressure on the civic budget. Staff are still hopeful that the final 2011 operating budget in December will be a balanced one. Media pundits have called the Olympic Village a ghost town because many of the units are still unoccupied. In an effort to fix this problem, NPA Councillor Susan Anton tabled a motion to help promote vibrancy in that community, suggesting that city staffers look at ways to encourage buskers and other programming, as well as vendors in the area.
Your Worship, I'm not talking about the city spending money here. I'm simply talking about the city facilitating animation in the square. I'm talking about perhaps giving the space away, which may be in a way costing money, but if somebody can come down and do coffee for free on a temporary basis, maybe that's a good thing, rather than going through the complicated thing of licensing and permits and so on.
Ultimately, councillors voted to amend the proposal and instead asked the city manager to bring these ideas up with the developer. a subtle difference that will mean city staffers will not be drumming up solutions to the problem of a quiet athlete's village, but rather will look to the developers to address the issue. The 100th Laneway House was approved this past July. This week, Council heard feedback about how the new type of housing was affecting residents. The new homes were widely distributed throughout the city and are starting to catch on, with 1 out of 8 new lots developed, including a laneway house. These backyard apartments have many benefits for the city in terms of increasing lower rent housing options in a city with low vacancy rates. However, many people whose neighbors have erected laneway houses spoke against this type of infill housing, raising concerns about privacy and sight lines. Here's West Side resident Merv McGrath discussing his concerns.
And this past summer, a laneway house, a monster laneway house, went up beside us. It's basically 20 feet high and 40 feet wide. We don't sit on our back deck anymore. We've lost the enjoyment of that outdoor area. Looking through your laneway house guidelines, I come across quite often the words modest and neighborly, and this laneway house is neither of those to us. Also in the guidelines it says that the windows on the upper level should be, the primary window should be facing the lane. We have 2 windows on the upper level facing us and 1 facing the lane, and that's not according to your guidelines. We really object to the excessive height. It does block our solar access. That's words taken from your guidelines. And it has a huge perceived scale, also from your guidelines.
In a report, staffers suggested the city address some of the problems with what they call livability and neighborliness by decreasing the maximum allowable height of new laneway houses to 1 floor from 1.5. Council will revisit the issue again with another update when the 150th laneway house is approved for construction. This has been your City Hall Update. I'm Megan Turcato.
And thanks to Megan Turcato, as always, for bringing us that report. We apologize for any technical difficulties you may have experienced.
It's now time for a special report from News 101 reporter Adam Yanush, who spoke to Nikki Ashton, NDP MP from Churchill, Manitoba. Ashton was at the UBC sub earlier today collecting signatures in support of a bill to protect and improve higher education at the federal level through stable funding similar to the Canada Health Transfer. She sat down with Adam in the CITR lounge and spoke about the proposed bill as well as about apathy amongst younger voters and the challenge of being a young woman in Parliament today.
Okay, so I'm sitting here with Nikki Ashton, who is the youngest woman MP in Parliament today. First off, hello, welcome to the sub at UBC.
Hello, great to be here.
So tell me why you're here today.
Well, we're here with our NDP candidate in this area, and Victor and our whole team of New Democrats promoting the work we're doing in Ottawa. On November 25th, we'll be presenting a bill calling on the federal government to show leadership when it comes to post-secondary education. Canadian students, as many of you, the listeners, will know, are increasingly saddled by, the cost of an education, alarmingly high student debt rates. We're reaching a collective amount of $20 billion, numbers that we've never heard of before. And what we have is a federal government, both liberal and conservative, that have shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it's up to the province. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to move forward as a country, sure, we talk about education, but what we need is the federal government to actually put their, put the money where it matters most, which is investing in the next generation, ensuring that students don't come out with debilitating student debt that, as we know now from studies coming out, is preventing us from carrying on with our careers, is preventing us from, in the first place, finishing our education, slowing us down when it comes to starting a family or investing in a home, and certainly putting us back compared to the generation of our parents. And that's, in the time of recession and a time when we're scrambling to figure out what how we're going to move forward, we need the federal government being part of the solution and supporting Canadian students.
So tell me, on a practical level, what does the bill propose?
Sure. Well, what we're calling for is a dedicated transfer from the federal to the provincial governments with regards to post-secondary education. It's modeled along the idea of the Canada Health Act. Mm. So instead of the federal government giving the general transfer of funding that the province ends up using on all sorts of things, we're saying that there needs to be a dedicated amount of money going simply to post-secondary education. Now, the province will choose to administer it best, but we're saying that the point here is to alleviate the burden on students, to support institutions that are providing a post-secondary education, also to support provinces trying to make a go of establishing accessible education in their region, but certainly making it accountable so that the federal government can say, hey, listen, we're giving this money, and we want to see a difference for students.
Do you think that this federal government, the Conservative government, and just the state of Parliament in general, do you think there is support for even the idea of higher education?
Well, that's why we're also out here, is because we're calling on young people across the country to be part of the movement to say we want action. I mean, so far we've had a conservative government. They've pursued certain kinds of action around loans, the loan system, and we're saying that approach is it's part of the equation, but certainly it's not being proactive. You know, we haven't seen them support the idea of a post-secondary Act. This is on the heels of a Liberal government some years ago that cut transfers to the provinces that assisted in post-secondary education. So essentially we have a government and an official opposition that certainly hasn't been prioritizing the investment in post-secondary education. We in the NDP have been saying that if we're going to move forward as a country, it seems pretty obvious that we need to be investing in education and supporting the next generations coming up, at a time of economic recession, mm-hmm. right? So we're hoping that the Conservative government, that the Liberal opposition, all parties in the House can stand behind this legislation, but that's where we need Canadians to speak to their representatives and say, listen, this is the kind of action we want to see.
Is this where the petition comes in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're, people's signatures and will be presented in the House of Commons. And it's also a chance for us to connect with students on the ground and say, have you talked to your MP? Have you talked to your candidates? Certainly, we in the NDP are keen to pass that, make that message loud and clear. But we all have a role to play. And, as a young person myself, I know our generation is sort of the last to get on board when it comes to voting, if we do ever get on board. That has to change in and of itself. But what we also need to, take up is the need to get on the case of our elected officials and say, what are you doing to represent our generation?
Mm-hmm. So I want to get a sense of, do you think you'll get much support when it's presented on the floor, particularly in a political climate where there's a lot of talk of personal responsibility, user fees, and everybody's got to pay their own way and all that kind of stuff, and of course with the Conservatives being in charge, what are your chances of getting support once the bill is presented?
Well, that's where we hope that the Canadian students, young people, university communities can be part of that push to get the Conservative government and also the Liberal Party to get behind this kind of an initiative. We've heard a lot of talk about the importance of education and investments in the stimulus package when it comes to bricks and mortar, when in fact we know the major burden on the cost of an education is on students. Mm-hmm. I think that it's absolutely critical to point to this individual agenda and sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of way of looking at the world. The reality is that our parents paid far less when it came to getting an education. and you know, the support in terms of grants and accessibility was there. Affordability was there. You know, and Canada's a growing country, increasingly diverse. You know, we need to see measures responding to the challenges that students from all backgrounds, Aboriginal students face. You know, and you know, Canada's changed, but what's also changed is the fact that our government is leaving our generation out on the cold. And it's not just when it comes to post-secondary education. There's a whole host of issues that you know, our generation's interests aren't being taken into account, and as a result, you know, many of us feel that Canada's turning backward, and it's our generation that's going to, at the end of the day, live a worse quality, have a worse quality of life than those that have come before us, and that's not the way to move forward.
Now, you mentioned the young generation not being too enthused or one of the last to sort of get on board with politics. I wonder, as not only a young person, but as the youngest woman MP, I just want to ask you, cynicism gut check. Where's your level of cynicism at as a person who's not only engaged in politics, but someone who's actually there in Ottawa in Parliament?
Well, I can say as a young woman sitting in the House of Commons, where you know, the imbalance in terms of gender and the imbalance in terms of age is you know, it's pretty stark, you know, and what it results is you know, when we get up and debate issues, whether it's the war in Afghanistan that is you know, where our generation has paid the highest cost in terms of lives, whether it's in terms of you know, the recession that has left our generation struggling to find entry level jobs, let alone, you know, you know, the stable ones. You know, when it comes to dealing with the fact that you know, our generation is increasingly being targeted when it comes to regressive public safety policies and throwing us into jail rather than looking at prevention or rehabilitation, you know, our voices simply don't get heard. You know, I'm at the age of 28, you know, I have felt it critical to bring forward the voices from my region, which is you know, in northern Canada, Churchill, which is one of the youngest regions in Canada, and to say, you know, we need to be heard, and I'm proud to be part of the NDP, a party that you know, sees issues being in terms of you know, faced directly by young people, but seeing it in a way that affects all of us, right? This is about all of our well-being if, you know, if our generation is supported. Mm-hmm. You know, and sure, there's moments of cynicism and real frustration, but for me, that's a drive to keep going. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that, you know, coming out here to BC and traveling across the country, I'm inspired by the activism on our campuses.